This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, in our top story, Texas plumbing regulations got flushed during the recent legislative session. We'll hear how the governor is reacting to that. We'll also get a roundup of some local runoff elections, some victories and some defeats for taxpayers around the state. For an interview, it's Index Release Week. We'll break down the results of the 2019 Fiscal Responsibility Index with Carrie Cheshire. And we'll close with a guest commentary from Charles Blaine of Urban Reform. Welcome back, friends, to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 Studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. Lots of articles going up there on a daily basis. News you need to know as a taxpayer to stay informed and engaged in your state and local government. With this week's top story, I've got Brandon Waltons, Capital Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. Brandon, I wanted to talk about plumbers.
Plumbers.
Yeah, okay. And for listeners out there, okay, we're not just talking about how to fix your pipes. There probably is some kind of like handyman show that we could do or something. But this is really a very interesting issue in state government. Mm-hmm. Involves whether our sunset process works. It involves, you know, executive lawmaking. It's all these things wrapped up. But we start with this, the plumbers seemingly about to be unregulated.
Yeah,
tell us about how this has happened.
It's interesting how many of those factors that you talk about actually play into this. So right now, if you were a free market loving Texan who doesn't like occupational licensing, certainly a lot of problems there for the free market, then you actually got a pretty good, I called it an accidental victory here because of the legislature's action or rather inaction in extending the regulatory agency that oversees plumbers, the Texas State Board of Plumbing Examiners.
Yeah, so basically there was this dispute mm-hmm. in the legislature. One group of nobody involved really wanted to deregulate plumbing. There was a group that wanted to regulate them with one agency. There was another group that wanted to regulate them with another agency. They didn't meet an agreement on this, and so poof.
And time ran out.
Right? Time ran out, and there's no regulation of plumbers.
And that's exactly what happened. And shortly after that happened, you had folks on one side saying, well, it wasn't really our biggest legislative priority heading into the session to deregulate the plumbing industry in Texas. But, there's other states that already do that. States like Wyoming, Kansas, they already don't regulate plumbers. So Texas wouldn't be alone in that. But then on the other side, you had the plumbing boards themselves essentially looking out for their own kind of protectionist interests and saying, no, please license us. We don't want the market flooded with these new plumbers.
Yeah, so a lot of us were looking at this saying, okay, you're going into September. Mm-hmm. These plumbing regulations are going to go away. Anybody basically can just be a plumber, right? If somebody will hire you to do plumbing work, then you can be a plumber, right?
Yeah.
A very simple proposition. The plumbers themselves saying, no, we want to be regulated. We have to be regulated. Please come regulate us.
And that's one of the biggest overarching problems we see with occupational licensing is that they're sold in the guise of this is for safety, this is for this is for the consumer, and in a lot of ways it's actually just for the industries themselves.
Now, I mentioned executive lawmaking. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Governor Abbott's, if not actions, statements.
Yeah, so amidst the plumbers' calls for a special session to address this emergency now, Governor Abbott went out and said, cool it, basically. I'm going to do something. Plumbers will continue to be licensed until the next legislative session for the next 2 years. Not really sure exactly how he's going to go about that. The legislature did not extend the term of this board. He says he has some tools in his toolbox. We'll see what they end up doing on that front.
Yeah, it's very confusing. You basically look at it and say, is he going to break the law to regulate? Because there is no law for regulating plumbers anymore.
Right, exactly. So will he move that to a new agency with some sort of executive power? I suppose we'll see.
Yeah. Well, it's something to keep an eye on. It'll be very interesting to see what happens here, kind of the intersection of occupational freedom, mm-hmm. occupational licensing, executive power. Lots to keep an eye on as we get into the latter part of this year.
Yeah, we'll be watching it coming down the pipe.
Now let's turn and talk to Aaron Anderson up at the DFW Metroplex. We had the runoff elections over the last week and some taxpayer victories up there in the Metroplex. Tell us about it.
Well, that's right, Tony. There were two Plano City Council seats that went to a runoff election, and we had two local grassroots-supported candidates facing off against two candidates endorsed by Plano's mayor, Harry LaRoselier, and a group of outside high-density developers who threw in tens of thousands of dollars into the race. So big victory there for the grassroots candidates. Shelby Williams defeated an incumbent, Ron Kelly, for place five, and Lily Bao won an open seat, place seven, over Democrat Ann Backus.
Yeah, I know that y'all had been doing quite a bit of writing about these races, really interesting, with Backus in particular having lots of ties to the Democrats. And you think traditionally, you know, Plano, there's this conservative area, but Backus really had a strong campaign, and you really saw the taxpayers there have to go out and do a lot of work to ensure that they didn't have this Democrat insurgency in their local city council.
That's right, Tony. Ann Backus, a Democrat precinct chair, rather controversial. She had done a fundraising event last year for a Democrat congresswoman, Ilhan Omar, who's been very notorious for some anti-Semitic comments.
Definitely been in the news, that's right.
But the big story was the money. Backus and Kelly were endorsed, supported, had a ton of money thrown in from this big pack called We Love Plano. Sounds nice, but it was really a bunch of real estate developers and the mayor throwing money at
them. We love making money in Plano.
Exactly, exactly. They put over $100,000 just in Ann Backus's campaign.
Yeah. Other race, I guess a quick update there, the Dallas mayor's race.
Right. That race saw Democrat State Representative Eric Johnson facing off against Scott Griggs, a progressive four-term city council member. He was term limited out and running for mayor. So we had the left and left running against each other, and Eric Johnson won that one.
Yeah, the very far left against the extremely far left in Dallas
right.
County. Very far left beat extremely far left in the mayor's race. Thanks for your reporting on it, Aaron.
You bet, Tony. Thank you.
Next, let's turn to Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau. Some disappointment for folks in grassroots down in San Antonio.
Yeah, Tony, a big decision in San Antonio this weekend. The city's residents voted to reelect Mayor Ron Nirenberg by a narrow 51-49 split.
Yeah, so this was the race that had drawn a lot of attention from around the state over basically religious discrimination against Chick-fil-A.
Exactly. Originally, the race was kind of non-competitive. It was expected to be a blowout for Nirenberg, but in March, he voted to ban Chick-fil-A from San Antonio's airport, which kindled a real contention in the community.
Yeah, and so you had this other guy, Brockhaus was one of the city councilmen.
Greg Brockhaus, yeah.
Yeah, so he had voted against this measure that was discriminating against Chick-fil-A, and it became a major issue in the campaign there.
Oh, exactly. They voted to ban Chick-fil-A solely because of the company's owner's beliefs on marriage. And so the decision sparked national backlash, including an investigation by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton.
Yeah, so you've got that investigation going forward and you know, the repercussions. They had a little bit of action in the legislature on religious freedoms. There's kind of some success stories there as a result of this. But basically, you had the city discriminating against a Christian business. It was because of like some donations to the Salvation Army.
Exactly. They were donating to radical organizations like Fellowship of Christian Athletes and Salvation Army.
Yeah, so this, this is what was at stake there. So pushed into this runoff election, and unfortunately, the grassroots groups that were backing Brockhaus coming up just shy.
They did. And another thing, Tony, is Mayor Ron Nirenberg has already voted to raise citizens' taxes multiple times. The average San Antonio homeowner is now paying roughly $400 more more per year than they did just a handful of years ago. Some big implications and consequences out of this election.
Yeah, well, it'll be one of those things, certainly disappointment, but one would hope that the taxpayer groups and people who organized in this race can continue to organize and take back control of their city from this, you know, far left element that seems to have taken root there.
Absolutely, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to have on Carrie Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. It's index release week. The 2019 Fiscal Responsibility Index is out, and I wanted to have you in and talk a little bit about what that project is, what folks can learn from it, and some of the takeaways, what we can learn from it about this most recent legislative session. So good to have you in to talk about that.
Always good to be in 1836 studios, Tony.
So tell folks who are listening at home, what is the Fiscal Responsibility Index? They didn't know anything about it. What is it?
Sure. Well, the Fiscal Responsibility Index is our tool of grading lawmakers' commitment to fiscal responsibility in limited government. So interested citizens can go visit our website, index.empowertexans.com. Once you arrive there, you can see exactly how your lawmaker did, what was their top line grade, and then you can go and get the full test, all 170 votes that we considered in the Texas House, all 149 votes that we considered in the Texas Senate, how your lawmaker voted, what our stance on the issue was, determine whether or not you agree with it, and then hold your lawmaker accordingly accountable.
Yeah, so let's break all this down. That's the 10,000 foot view. But basically what we have here is an index, a rating of votes. So it's for people out there who say, you know, I kind of want to know how my legislator voted on these fiscal issues. Let's break down a little bit, like, what are the votes that are used in the process of selecting those?
Well, that's a great question, Tony. So during the course of the Texas legislature or any major deliberative body, you have a ton of bills come through, but most of them, as you know, aren't really that consequential. You might be naming a highway after a retired game warden or honoring an Eagle Scout for completing his project. Those are worthy and good things, but they're not really core government things. They're not votes that we would want to consider on the index. So what we do is we read the bills that are coming before the Texas legislature in advance, and then we publish on our website, and we email out to any citizen in the state of Texas who wants to know what our particular stance is on a piece of legislation and why. So we might say, for example, you know, we are for House Bill 100 because we think it deregulates an industry that government doesn't need to be involved in. Or we might say we're against Senate Bill 5 because it's implementing a new government program that we don't think needs to exist. So we put those out. We get feedback from citizens and legislators all throughout the process. Sometimes they say, hey, you know, you did not rate Senate Bill 18. We think that might actually line up with your legislative priorities, your core issues that you care about. Or, you know, maybe, hey, we actually saw House Bill 18 a different way. We think that maybe perhaps it's a good bill and y'all aren't recognizing that, and here's why. And we're responsive to that feedback. You know, nobody's perfect. Sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes, most of the time, we get it right.
or at least you hope so, right?
Hope so, and then we issue updates to that as well. But this is, you know, everything is known by legislators in advance of the vote, what our stance is, and then they choose to vote however they wish. And then we make citizens across the state informed of how they voted on those issues.
So let's get down to the nitty-gritty here. Grades, we actually, it's like a report card. And so there's A's, B's, C's, F's. You know, people are said, okay, they get an F, they fail the index.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you know, in the House, we've got 170 votes. All of them are counted equally except budget and tax votes, which get a little bit more additional weight, something pretty fitting for something that's called the Fiscal Responsibility Index. But you've got everything on there from a bill relating to property tax reform to tax relief to deregulating children's lemonade stands and saying that busybody bureaucrats at the local level can't send health inspectors and police officers to shut someone down for peddling country time lemonade.
Hassle Timmy for selling country time. dime on the wrong street corner.
Exactly.
So, right. So these are the things that go into the index, and you know, every legislator gets a rating. So it's all the, it's not, you know, just some subset. All the Republicans, all the Democrats, everyone gets a score on this index.
Well, that's right. And as you can imagine, there's some individuals who make high marks and there's some individuals who make low marks, and a lot of individuals in between. You know, we see constantly on the fiscal conservative or fiscal responsibility index, you traditionally see Republicans fare better than Democrats, because Republicans, of course, campaign on fiscal responsibility, limited government, cutting spending, those sorts of things, where Democrats are campaigning to increase spending, add additional programs, maybe even increase taxes. And so you can imagine in the broader case, the general trends show that Republicans are more fiscally conservative. But I think a lot of Texans would be surprised that, number one, most Texas Republicans aren't that much more fiscally conservative than the Democrats are. And number two, that's not maybe the case for all Republicans. Maybe there are some Republicans where Democrats fare a little bit better than them.
Yeah, so let's talk about those issues. I think that's pretty interesting. Sarah Davis, specifically, a Republican, a little Freudian slip there, a Republican from the Houston area. A lot of people say, oh, she's notorious as a pro-Planned Parenthood, pro-abortion rights Republican, one of the only openly pro-choice Republicans out there. But a lot of the campaign rhetoric says, oh, well, she's your conservative voice. She's a libertarian. Some libertarians want to claim her. You know, she's a fiscally conservative representative, but she's socially liberal. This index, and there's other representatives who kind of fall into this vein, this index kind of pricks the bubble on that for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Sarah Davis from kind of Rice Village, West University Place in Houston, has this cachet that she's, oh, well, I'm a social moderate, I'm kind of a libertarian, but I'm a real fiscal conservative. The facts of the matter is the fiscal responsibility index, in which we don't consider, you know, voting to ban abortion or voting for guns on college campuses or bills like that. This is a fiscal responsibility votes and role of government votes. So we leave the gun votes to the gun groups and the life votes to the life groups, people who are friends and allies in this fight.
Yeah.
But we try to stay in our lane and talk about just this issue. And yeah, you do see that there are two Democrats, State Representative Richard Raymond of Laredo and State Representative Ryan Guillen of kind of Rio Grande City, who are more fiscally conservative than Sarah Davis is on our fiscal responsibility index. And you start digging into the votes, and oftentimes you are. I mean, you're seeing Sarah Davis vote with governments to expand welfare, vote to increase spending at the state level. And I think you've actually written a piece on TexasScorecard.com about how basically she trades her Republican brand to kind of give credence to Democrat ideas.
Well, that and also takes up, you know, I'm putting air quotes here, Republican spots on committees. So a lot of times you'll have a committee that's balanced 9 members, 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats. It's kind of a natural thing that happens a lot. And but then it's really almost essentially 5 Democrats because she's on there voting with the Democrat bloc. I don't want to single her out and talk spin. You know, this isn't the Sarah Davis critique show, but there are other representatives kind of in this group who are Republicans who are just, you know, a teensy bit more fiscally conservative than the top performing Democrats. I mean, there's quite a few that are kind of in that close range.
Yeah, and I do kind of want to march up from Sarah Davis. So Sarah Davis comes in with a 30 out of 100 on the fiscal responsibility index. Of course, this is the grades are just like they are in Texas schools. A 70 or above is considered a passing grade. A 69 or below is considered a failing grade. But scoring just above State Representative Sarah Davis is Ryan Guillen, a actually pro-life, pro-gun Democrat. Down from South Texas. And then Richard Raymond, who actually gave a speech on the Senate floor in favor of banning taxpayer-funded lobbying, a Democrat who wanted to ban taxpayer-funded lobbying in Texas.
That's one of the Republican Party's top priorities.
One of the Republican Party's top priorities. Meanwhile, Sarah Davis was working with Democrats to weaken that bill. So I think it kind of bolsters the credibility of our index. And then, of course, the lowest scoring Republican after Sarah Davis on our fiscal responsibility index is J.M. Lozano, who changed parties from Democrat to Republican. So,
yeah, so kind
it
of,
about it, follows what you would expect.
Yeah, let's go up the list, talk about a couple of those, and then I want to talk about some of the high performers. Who else were some of the low-performing people, some of the lowest-performing Republicans on that index?
Well, I think what might be a very big surprise to most Texans is that, you know, one of the lowest-scoring Republicans comes from the Texas Panhandle, Ken King, who, a former school board member, someone who is routinely sided with educrats and against taxpayers, and doesn't believe that the state spends enough, comes in with only a 37 on the fiscal responsibility index. And you see a number of other lawmakers, Dan Huberty, Republican from Kingwood.
This is the guy making education policy for the state, basically, as a public education chair.
Exactly. And then longtime members like J.D. Sheffield and Charlie Guerin. But you see there are a lot of kind of old guard Republicans who campaign as, well, I'm the guy wearing a cowboy hat and I don't like Washington, D.C., and here's my family in the blue bonnets. And people automatically think that they're conservatives, but then you actually start looking in at their votes in the Texas legislature, or in the case of Ken King, at the local level, where he campaigned as, I'm the guy who raises taxes. You know, it's a far cry from, I think, the results that most Texans would expect.
Yeah,
Texans,
well, and you're seeing out of these guys, like, just a few points of separation from the Democrats, and then, you know, it goes up. So what? Let's talk a little bit about the averages. I think that tells a little bit of the story. What's the average kind of caucus average for the Republicans? Where was that?
The Republican average is right about in the 50s.
Okay.
You have a number of individuals down there in the 30s, a lot in the 40s, a lot in the 50s. And then you only have about, I think, about 16 or so passing in the Texas House.
So what did we have? 83 Republicans, mm-hmm. 16 of those actually getting a passing grade, 70 or above on the index.
That's right.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those higher performers. Who had the top scores on the index? Let's talk about those scores.
Right, so in the Texas House, we actually had six individuals make A's on the Fiscal Responsibility Index, and they started off with State Representative Jonathan Stickland of Bedford coming in with a 98. Jonathan has routinely topped the Fiscal Responsibility Index. He scored straight 100s in his most previous three sessions. But even here, you saw some regression in the Texas House where he dropped 2 points. And that's largely due to the fact that I think you saw his political transformation at the beginning of the session where he was trying to work with leadership, trying to work with other once conservative lawmakers who were trying to do the same, and then realized as the budget was coming out and after the school finance plan was coming out that it was very clear that they had been sold a bill of goods and that he needed to reject those proposals. But you go on down the list, you see State Representative Briscoe Kane, a very fiery conservative lawmaker, the author of the free speech bill that most recently passed, Mays Middleton, highest scoring freshman lawmaker from down in Chambers County, doing very well with a 93 on the Fiscal Responsibility Index, Tony Tenderholt from Arlington, Kyle Biederman from Fredericksburg, and then Mike Lang from Granbury. Changing gears, in the Texas Senate, we only had one lawmaker who scored an A on the Fiscal Responsibility Index, and that was State Senator Bob Hall, who skated by with a 90. Of course, in Bob's two previous sessions, he scored a 100 on the Fiscal Responsibility Index.
And so I think that's some of the story of the session, was a little bit of regression at the top end of these most conservative legislators. And it kind of felt like what was missing. As we look at this session, you saw maybe a lack of aggressive pressure, a lack of fight from the most conservative reps, and it kind of gets reflected in the voting pattern here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at the big three. You saw Dan Patrick go from someone who was the hard-charging forefront, pushing for conservative issues, to someone who kind of leaned back. And, you know, literally, this is the guy who said, hey, we need to protect privacy and we need to ban the automatic collection of union dues. Those are my priorities. 2 years ago, this session, we need to raise the smoking age to 21 and invest in rural broadband. That's a pretty big far cry from what he was 2 years ago. And then, of course, you look in the Texas Senate, where, look, a lot of it was a math problem, where conservatives lost a number of seats in the Texas Senate. Three people who scored 100, State Senator Don Huffines, Connie Burton, and Van Taylor, did not return to
the Texas legislature.
That's right. Two going down in the general election, one of them going to Congress and doing good work there. But I think that really tested the Texas Senate, it was very difficult for conservatives to get good reform across the finish line. And then in the House, I think you saw a lot of maybe we'll kind of go along and see if we can get along. And they did get along. They just didn't get any policy victories.
They got along. It was very friendly, but not productive. As we're running out of time, tell listeners, how do they get connected with this? What can they go online? What can they find there that they might find useful?
Well, that's a great question, Tony. So they ought to visit index.empowertexans.com to see how their lawmaker voted on every single issue. You can go and scroll down. As I mentioned before, we have 170 votes in the House, over 100 in the Texas Senate. See how your lawmaker voted on the issue and see if you agree with us. You know, if we gave somebody a 98 and you scroll through and you see, you know, actually, I think I disagree with Empower Texans, that's a positive thing. You're now more informed as a citizen and you can hold your lawmaker accountable. You can adjust that score to a 100. Likewise, you can choose, you know, maybe I need to talk to my legislator about this. Maybe I need to pat him on the back. He did a good job on this vote. Maybe I need to wag a finger at him and let him know that that's not a good idea and he needs to do better next time. Or maybe I need to organize with my friends and replace them.
That's right. Well, I appreciate your work on it. Great tool out there, index.empowertexans.com. This week we have a guest commentary from our good friend Charles Blaine with Urban Reform. Charles touches on the human impact of occupational licensing.
Not all occupational licensing is created equally. Of course, there's a general consensus that licensing doctors and engineers is important and provides a health and safety benefit to the public. But the same can't be said about licensing occupations like interior designers and auctioneers. This is Charles Blaine, founder and executive director of Urban Reform, with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary. An occupational license is essentially a permission slip from state or local government allowing you to work in a preferred industry. The license acts as proof that you are proficient enough to provide a service without endangering the public. In some lines of work, a license seems easily justifiable. But licenses aren't limited to just those industries that carry a high risk to public safety. Instead, we've seen the occupational licensing system turn into a scheme used to protect industry insiders by making it harder and more expensive for others to enter that job market. This, in turn, drives up costs of employment and costs for consumers. One report found that in the 1950s, only about 5% of workers needed a government license to work. Today, that number is about one-third of workers. Thankfully, we're seeing a movement to scale back some of the regulations, or at least make them easier to comply with. Licensing areas that don't pose any significant risk to the public in terms of health and safety hinders economic mobility. It's easier for people with the financial means or the spare time to dedicate to obtain a license, but for those who have to work to put food on the table, licensing requirements can present a huge barrier to starting a new business or entering a new industry. In some cases, it can even take more than a year to get all the paperwork done. In Texas, for instance, it takes about 350 days of training to become a licensed cosmetologist, while it only takes about 35 days to become a certified EMT. Is cutting hair 10 times more complicated than saving lives? Those with low income or who work long hours that prohibit them from putting in the time on training can face hurdles, forcing them to decide between living in their status quo or trying to better their lives. What makes it worse is that many cities and urban governments are following the state's lead and implementing their own regulations on top of or in lieu of the state's. For instance, after the Texas legislature abolished licensing for plumbing, the city of Houston announced a plan to roll out new licensing regulations if the state didn't move to bring them back. In some other states, local governments levy plumbing requirements on top of their state's requirements, doubling the cost of licensure and driving up the cost for service. Do toilets somehow flush differently in one city or another? No, these regulations are designed to stifle competition, not protect the consumers. Occupational licensing may have its place, but right now it's far-reaching, difficult net to navigate, and costly for those who need the opportunities the most. Texans should continue to fight to scale back these regulations while being alert and prepared to fight them from being implemented on the local level. This is Charles Blaine with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary.
Well, that's all I have for you this week. As Carrie mentioned in our interview, go check out the Fiscal Responsibility Index, index.empowertexans.com.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.